This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, back live. Today marks the seventh day of Ramadan, the Islamic holy month. It honors the time when the Prophet Muhammad received the first revelations of the Quran. A key part of observing Ramadan is fasting, so many Muslims do not eat or drink from dawn to sunset. That abstinence is offset by meals before dawn and after sunset, and the end of Ramadan is also marked by a feast, Eid al-Fitr. Among the many different ways to break a fast, one that's gained popularity in recent years are halal charcuterie boards, where traditional pork would be replaced with halal salami and featuring pastrami and cheese made without animal enzymes. Joining us to talk about all this and more is Narges Rahman, reporter for WDET, the NPR station in Detroit. Narges, welcome to the 21st show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Awad Awad, director of the Salaam Mina Cultural Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. MENA is an acronym for Middle Eastern and North African. Awad, welcome to the show and to Illinois.
The honor is all mine. Thank you.
Listeners, I also want to invite you to join our conversation today, as ever, at 800-222-9455, especially if you are fasting during Ramadan. I wonder, do you find it easy to find halal options in your community? And, you know, how do you go about marking this holiday, especially if it is challenging in your part of Illinois? Let us know. 800-222-9455 is the number. Again, that's 800-222-9455. So, Narges, I want to begin with you. What are your earliest memories of Ramadan?
You know, I grew up in the Temple Terrace community in Florida, and at that time, we were one of a few Bangladeshi families living in that area, but we went to the mosque where it was very diverse, and we had this amazing community where everyone just felt like family. And so I remember going to the mosque at night to pray Tarawih every day, even if on school nights, and really wanting to participate in fasting and be, you know, like the adults. And I remember fasting as early as like 7 years old. And it's something that I look forward to every year. I think it's very momentous and something that everyone is really excited about every single year.
Was that a challenge? Working? Did you have to work up to that when you're 7 years old?
I think, you know, kids, we really want to be just like the adults. Like there's something exciting about waking up in the middle of the night and eating with your parents, looking out, it's like pitch black, and then being able to fast and then compete with your cousins and your friends of how many days did you fast? And if you're able to keep all the fasts, I think it's almost like a competition in a good way, right? trying to rack up all the prizes and all the, you know, getting all the praises from the adults at the same time. So I think it is something you work up to, but I think it's something that kids want to participate in. And that's absolutely how I felt as a kid. And that's how my kids feel now as well.
Yeah, they want to be like the grownups. That's great. What about you? Do you have a, what's your sort of earliest memories of observing Ramadan?
As a kid growing up in Michigan, on the outskirts of Detroit and Ann Arbor in a city called Jackson. My parents are Palestinian from a small town between Jericho and Jerusalem who lived in Latin America before coming to the US. So our dinner table was usually a mix of Palestinian food, Michigander food at the time, Puerto Rican, Colombian. Again, as Narges said, the competition with the adults. I think whenever I come across descriptions of Ramadan in the U.S., what's missing is the cultural spirit. I mean, think of an entire month of the Christmas spirit with Thanksgiving meals, you know, and the little you know, traditions that come with it. And so, yeah, really fond memories, but also memories of being in school and people asking me, you can't eat, you can't drink. A lot of the administrators thinking that it's some sort of abuse. Just really interesting when I go back and reflect on it.
Yeah, that is interesting how people outside the community react to that. Well, let me ask, so one of the key elements of the food to break the fast is for it to be halal. And maybe, Awad, can you just talk a little bit about what exactly that means for members of our audience who might be from different faith traditions?
If I can begin by a little joke here, I remember on Seinfeld when George was on the airplane and he asked for a kosher meal, and two older ladies sitting near him, one asks the other, what does kosher mean? And the other responds with, it's the special way they kill the pig. yeah. Muslims and Jews, if there's one line that they usually don't cross, no matter where they are in the spectrum of religious observance, is eating pork. Although there's a growing trend among both to do so. But halal just means a special way that the animal is slaughtered to be as humane as possible, drain blood, and other things. Muslims are usually a little much more lenient than the ultra-Orthodox kosher standards, but you do find communities within the Muslim world that also refrain from fish with scales or shrimp and so on and so forth.
You mentioned Michigander foods on your diverse table growing up.
Yes.
Was it a challenge adapting Michigan? One, what is a Michigander food? And two, is it halal?
Michigander food for me was my experience of America at the time, right? Before the internet. So everything that was American to me was whatever my surroundings were. But that included, mashed potatoes, that included turkey, that included gravy, foods that we would think to be traditional American food, especially with the Polish, German, Irish influences in my part of the state where I lived.
Yeah, yeah. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk more about this, and particularly the charcuterie board aspect of this. I'm learning how to pronounce that word properly. We're talking about all this with Awad Awad, who is director of the Salaam Mina Cultural Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Narges Rahman, who is a reporter with WDET, the public radio station in Detroit. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st show. If you want to join us, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about Ramadan. We're in the seventh day of the Islamic holy month and the practice of fasting from dawn to sunset and how that fast is broken at the end of the day. Among the many different ways to do that, one that's gained popularity in recent years are halal charcuterie boards, where you maybe would replace things like pork sausage with halal salami, and your pastrami and cheese and other things would be made without animal enzymes. We're talking about all this with Awad Awad, who is director of the Salaam Mina Cultural Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Narges Rahman, a reporter with the NPR station in Detroit, WDET. And Narges also wrote the article, Grazing Boards Meet Ramadan, How Women Entrepreneurs Are Bringing This Instagram Trend to the Halal Table. This was last year. But Narges, can you talk more about that? So, and maybe for people who aren't familiar with the Instagram trend, I've looked at the pictures in that article. Some of these layouts are just insanely beautiful, of people making elaborate shapes with their food. But talk about that trend and how you first got onto this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think during the pandemic, we saw this trend of people wanting to gather and then trying to figure out how to do that safely. So one of the things people were doing were having picnics outdoors or meeting outside. And that came with the, idea of snacking or having these, sometimes they're meals, right? These grazing boards or halal charcuterie boards. And like you mentioned, just replacing the meat element and the cheese element And then really personifying it to cultural needs of different Muslim communities. And so one thing is that Muslims come from all walks of life. And so there's this misconception, I think, that all Muslims are Arab American or all Arab Americans are Muslim, but quite the contrary, we have a huge diversity in the Muslim community. And so some of the halal charcuterie boards, you'll see that there's things from different cultures. For example, there are sweets like gulab jamun, which are sweets from the South Asian community, or you'll have dates, you'll have labneh, you'll have different aspects of different cultures adding onto these charcuterie boards. So personifying them to what the cultural needs are in those communities. And what I really found interesting was a lot of these charcuterie boards were being made by women. And I wasn't really surprised by that. I think women always find a solution to things. But specifically because during the pandemic, I saw this uptake in women coming up with creative ways to cater to their communities in terms of niche businesses. And I think we traditionally think of businesses as brick and mortars. But during the pandemic, as we remember, there was a period of time when restaurants were closed down. So people still wanted like good food, and they were trying to find new ways to like experiment with things. A lot of home cooking was in again, and people were a lot more willing to like pick up a charcuterie board, for example, maybe at someone's front porch and grab and go style without having to interact with restaurants or in the time when restaurants were not available, to kind of still have that homemade feeling or that preparation that someone puts behind that. And women were the ones doing these entrepreneur, things where they are giving back to their communities by creating these niche businesses.
I'm always curious where reporters get their ideas for stories. Is this something you encountered in the real world or online first, or was there that magic moment of intersection?
Well, I feel like I saw it, but I didn't quite know a lot about it. But one of my good friends from the kitchen, Halle Bey Ramdin, who I met through a food journalism workshop in Detroit a couple years back, she reached out to me and said, "You're talking about this, right? And if you're not, I think you should, because you might be the right person to do it." We learned how to do food writing through a fellowship at WDT a couple years back. And she thought it was something that ought to be talked about. I think I saw the trend and I didn't realize that people didn't know about it. I guess that's kind of how I looked at it. And I wanted to look behind the scenes at who was actually putting these things together and why does it matter so much. So I interviewed a couple of women from various cities around the United States, and different people had different things to say. But the biggest thing they had to say was how much fun it was to put these together and how much support their communities were coming out. Sometimes these are new concepts in communities. People are like, "What is that?" But you know, one person told me they got the uncle at the mosque to try the food on the charcuterie board, and so that was like the aha moment that really made it come together.
Yeah, the uncle at the mosque stamp of approval. All right, I want to play some audio now, and this is State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, who represents several southwest suburbs across Chicagoland. He is sponsoring legislation that would overhaul the way public school students in Illinois can request a halal or a kosher school lunch alternative. He wasn't able to join us live because of scheduling, but our producer, Jose Zepeda, talked to him yesterday. And this is what he had to say about having to eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for his school lunches.
But when I was a public school student, I ate those peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I never thought I could ask for halal meals. And so there are probably many students who are making do, but are not able to get the type of a meal or the type of nutrition that they need throughout the day.
Awad, Awad, I wonder, is this something that you encountered in your youth?
I have, actually. And, before joining Urbana Champagne as the director of the Sed Amina Cultural Center, I taught Arabic at North Atlanta High School. And one of the things that we were pushing for from faculty to staff, students, parents, is to have the schools offer not just more halal or offer halal and kosher options, but also vegan and vegetarian. Just to give a wide array for anybody and their lifestyle, the way they choose to eat. But extremely rare to find anything, halal in the schools that I went to.
Yeah. Nargis, what about you? What was your experience with finding halal food options, especially in your youth? Yeah.
So when I was younger, we didn't have halal food in school. And I think the closest even like halal shop we had was this sandwich shop that opened up like down the street from the mosque. So I remember on Fridays, we that was our like one, you know, American halal thing to eat, right? Like this really good sandwich that we could get. But now I live in Michigan, so I'm in Detroit, Metro Detroit. We've seen in the past few years, I would say in the past 5, 10 years, public schools are providing halal foods, and they're doing that because they're realizing that there's large populations of Muslim students in some of the school districts, like Dearborn Public Schools, for example, and Hamtramck Public Schools. That's something that people are kind of realizing that it really does matter to be able to provide sometimes the only meal that that child might be having for the whole day, especially in low-income communities. It's really important to be able to have kids feel like they're seen and heard. And my kids, I think, are super funny because I mean, I would never dare to take like biryani to lunch, for example. But for my kids, I do pack them lunch, and they've started to introduce halal foods in our school district, but they're not quite there yet because of demands from parents, and people are like talking about it and not afraid to do so. I think that in our generation, our parents kind of were more so assimilating, and we had to ha kind of figure it out at school. And now that we're parents in our generation, I'm trying to empower my kids to be, you know, stand up for what they want, but also like taking whatever they want from home. And it's really funny to me when they ask me to like pack them biryani, which is like a chicken and rice dish that's super popular across the world, and or like curry, like a chicken curry. And I'm like, are you sure you want to do that at school? And they're like, yeah, what's wrong with that, you know? So they're just really leading into the halal from home, and sometimes bypassing like just taking a sandwich or like a burger from home or anything like that.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. So they're, loud and proud, maybe, right? In a way that maybe you weren't when you were that age. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I mean, this is part of what your work does as a reporter, right? Challenging narratives, positive storytelling around minority communities. Can you talk about representation of Muslims in American culture, in American media, how that's changed over your lifetime?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would definitely agree with what you said. I think at school, the most things that I would eat at school was like cheese pizza, or I would just like buy some fries when I was younger and didn't have the halal food options. But in terms of covering minority communities and Muslim American coverage, it's changed so much in the past decade or so. And when I was going to school in undergrad, and I studied journalism at Wayne State University, we weren't allowed to really talk about our own cultural experiences or our religious views, obviously, because there's this thing called bias, right? But it's something that where the larger public is not subjected to. It's almost like if only if you're a minority can you not talk about your own communities. And it really bothered me because I think that we are experts in our own lived experiences. And while we might not report on ourselves, we're not talking about ourselves, we do know our communities the best. And we understand certain things that perhaps other reporters might not understand or have access to those communities. And so I grew up really frustrated not seeing stories of people like me or hearing stories that were positive about our communities around me. And I really wanted to change that. So that's something that I'm super passionate about. Something that I'm doing at WDET is called Communities of Hope. So during the pandemic, I noticed that a lot of people were not like, first of all, we weren't getting translated materials about COVID at all, right? In various languages that people speak or in ways that people can understand. So that was one problem. But despite that, I thought about how, you know, we were talking about mainstream communities and how people were dealing with COVID in good times and bad, but we were not talking to those minority communities and how people had these unique challenges like language barriers or having to be caretakers for older and younger generations, living in multi-generational homes and things like that. But I wanted to find a positive spin on that and see what people really were leaning into in terms of persevering and holding on to hope and being able to like get through those tough times. So what I ended up writing about a lot of were businesses. People were opening businesses to provide services that just weren't available during the pandemic and really following passion projects and things like that. So I'm all about finding those positive stories within the difficult times.
I want to play one more clip from State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, in the time we have remaining. Let's take a listen to that.
I think it can have a great impact. There are thousands and thousands of Muslim students and Jewish students throughout our state who would benefit tremendously by being able to, one, of course, eat food that follows their own dietary requirements, but also that makes them feel included, where they don't have to feel like they're being kind of sidelined or not taken or not being considered because of the dietary restrictions that they have.
So Awad, I think this is maybe the last question is going to go to you. The Salaam Mina Cultural Center is new, right, at the University of Illinois. What should students expect? What is the aim of the center?
The center is new, and what makes the center even more unique is, apart from being one of the very few Mina cultural centers in the U.S., is that this center also answers to student affairs and diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, you know, when growing up, you usually think that you are normal and the rest of the world is weird. And then you find out that we're all weird in our own ways. You know, but it was in graduate school at UCLA where I started to learn about this idea of, you know, imagined communities and the invention of tradition and so on and so forth. And so it gave me this different perspective on the power of narrative, the power of stories, and the power of human belief in them. And knowing that a lot of these stories, or not a lot, all the stories are constructed in time and space, and you know, with nationalism, they tend to be also exclusionary. You're defining yourself against an other. That the vision then becomes, okay, let's understand this narrative, deconstruct it, and reconstruct it to allow space for everyone. And that is the vision of the center. Anyone who has called or does call the region home shall be reflected and will be reflected in space, in whatever curriculum and programming. It's a safe space for anyone across the spectrum of ethnic identity, linguistic identity, religious identity and observance, gender identity. It's a safe space for all, is the vision here. And to educate ourselves about the region. I mean, even the term MENA itself is a contested term. And it doesn't include, you know, the culturally and linguistically related regions of the top third of East Africa, for example. So there's a lot to unpack, but, you know, but sometimes, you know, one of our problems is we think too much. And so for now, keeping MENA, you know, within the name, will work to our advantage once and hopefully if the MENA category on the census becomes a reality, issues of applying for scholarships and funding and so on and so forth.
Sure. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Awad is director of the Salaam Mina Cultural Center at the University of Illinois, brand new. We've also been speaking with Nargis Rahman, a reporter at WDET, the NPR station in Detroit. Thank you to both of you for joining us today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.